Today is Wednesday, January 25th. We're going to be wrapping up chemistry and beginning cell information today. So let's start with a review of the carb group. What is the monomer or building block for the carbs? Monosaccharide. And that means?
One
or simple sugar. Good. And so we do tend to find that monosaccharides are the ones that provide a quick burst of energy. Can you give me two or so examples of a monosaccharide?
Glucose.
Good. Excellent choice there. What's another one? Fructose. Good. And another one?
Galactose.
Good. Now, by the way, all three of those have the same chemical formula. It just happens to be C6H12O6. How do you know that these are monosaccharides?
Same.
Three to seven carbon atoms. Yeah, that's what qualifies them as monosaccharides. They have between 3 and 7 carbon atoms. Do notice the general formula is twice the number of hydrogens as carbons and oxygens.
Well,
something like that is going to be a monosaccharide. The ones we discuss are all the same formula. So that makes it easy for us to remember that C6H12O6 is always a monosaccharide. Glucose, galactose, yeah. I also want to mention that these three sugars you just mentioned, glucose, galactose, and fructose, are all the same chemical formula. They just happen to have slightly different structures. So how would you classify them?
Isomers.
Isomers, good. Not to be confused with isotopes, right? Okay, so isomers have the same formula, just different structures. You can see that glucose and galactose are really close in terms of structure. We've just flip-flopped the location of their hydrogens and hydroxyls. So how would you classify sucrose? Mono, di, or polysaccharide? Disaccharide. What does that mean?
Two
monosaccharides, right. Two simple sugars joined to form sucrose. Can you tell me which sugars form sucrose?
Glucose and fructose.
Good. By the way, do you recognize this reaction? Let's see, you got two choices, building or dehydration synthesis. Good. And so the alternate name for dehydration synthesis is? Anabolic. Bulk and build. Yeah, anabolic or building reactions. So yeah, that dehydration synthesis reaction is a building or anabolic reaction. So how did you know?
The water is at the end. It's an end product.
Good. It is an end product. Good. And of course, glucose is a mono, fructose is a mono, sucrose is a disaccharide. So 1 plus 1 is 2. If I flip-flop that reaction and have the product sitting where the reactants are, we'd be breaking down sucrose into its building block. So just keep in mind, look for where the water is located to guide you.
Or we may have to like look at that actual structure and be able to know whether which one's glucose or fructose or...
Not that.
Okay.
I may give you this and ask you to tell me what's happening, or I may ask you to tell me what's in the products or the reactant side, but definitely not the chemical structure.
And when you say what's happening, do you mean as far as
dehydration?
Is that one word not explaining?
No, it's just going to be a multiple choice.
Oh.
Yeah. We talked about three types of polysaccharides in class on Monday. The type that's stored in animals is what?
Glycogen.
Okay.
Oh, animal.
Animal, yeah. Where do we store, cellulose or starch? What kinds of organisms store those?
Plants,
good. And the thing is, they're all kind of made of the same basic structures, glucose molecules. It's the arrangement that makes them different. So in terms of energy, these particular polysaccharides are going to give you a much longer burn of energy. So if you were needing, say, some polysaccharide to last you from breakfast to lunch, these are a better choice than a monosaccharide. All right, so we are ready, it looks like, to start with the lipids. Do you guys have any question on the carbs?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so lipids actually have two building blocks. Those monomers are a fatty acid chain and a glycerol head. In fact, there's commonly three fatty acid chains, and so we call it a triglyceride for that reason. Okay, so a little oddness here. We actually have two building blocks, a fatty acid and a glycerol. Fats are a great way to insulate around your body's organs. They're also a good way to store excess energy. So we do find fats as being a way for us to hold on to energy for a day where we're perhaps spread thin and don't have the opportunity to eat. That's just a sampling of types on the bottom of your page here. Saturated and unsaturated fats, we'll talk about those. Glycerides, we're not going to talk about the eicosanoids. We'll talk about phospholipids and steroids, though. I'm just going to mention their name, and that's all. We're just going to keep on working from them. We're going to work on the other types instead. So let me share with you what a typical fat looks like. A typical fat has a glycerol head and a fatty acid chain. You may have one fatty acid chain or two or even three fatty acid chains. I think you'll notice if you look at these pictures, there's a lot of carbons and hydrogens that make up these fats. In fact, in the heads, the polar region, that's the glycerol portion, there's a lot of carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens linked together. But take a look at the fatty acid chain. There's carbons and hydrogens, lots and lots of them all linked together. Do you recognize the kind of bond that holds together the carbons and the hydrogens?
Single.
Single, good. Is it covalent or ionic?
Covalent.
Covalent, good. And of course, the other question is polar or nonpolar?
Nonpolar.
Nonpolar, right, because there are no symbols there. What are those little symbols?
Deltas.
Deltas, right. Okay. Now, the nature of the tail being nonpolar means that it's going to be hydrophobic. That means it hates what?
Water.
Yeah, so that tail being nonpolar means that it's hydrophobic. It is water fearing or it hates water. Now this picture of the head actually doesn't show you the deltas, but in fact there is an unequal sharing going on. Unequal sharing, that is what type of covalent molecule? Polar or nonpolar?
Polar.
Polar, yes. So this head in fact is a polar portion of the fat, and because it's polar, it loves water. Thus the name hydrophilic means that it's a water-loving portion of the fat. So this looks like some kind of opposites attract scenario, and in fact it is. You've got a water-loving polar head, and you've got water-hating or water-fearing nonpolar tails. So those two hook up together, and that's what actually creates the basic building block or structure of most of your fats. So what I'd like to do is talk about those fatty acid chains in a little more detail. On your worksheet, you should have unsaturated fats and saturated fats. Just taking a look at the pictures, can you tell me what's different between the saturated and the unsaturated chains?
It's
got a double bond.
You're right.
One's got a double
bond. One's got a double bond. That unsaturated one has a double bond. And what's missing in that neighborhood?
Two hydrogens,
yeah. So in fact, when you're missing hydrogens, those carbons turn to each other, they double bond, and of course that helps them to stabilize the valence shell. You know, keep in mind, what is the octet rule?
Eight.
Yeah, eight, so we're looking at eight in that valence shell for carbon. Carbon says, I gotta have eight to make me happy. It has four electrons that it shares with neighboring atoms, and so those are shared in pairs, so we've got 2, 4, 6, 8 total electrons being shared. So that's why there's a double bond here. It's a way to create stability for the carbon atom. But you guys noticed, you said that it kinked up or bent, and that's a great clue to look for because unsaturated fatty acid chains are kinky. Okay? So they're bent, they're kinked up every time that they've got a double bond. Now let's see, if you go to the grocery store and you're looking for some kinky unsaturated fats, what would you look for?
Vegetable oil, cooking oils,
good, yeah. Canola oil, vegetable oil, corn oil, you can keep on naming, olive oil. Go to the oil aisle, take a look at any of those bottles. They have large amounts of unsaturated fats. By the way, those are healthier, okay? Because there's less hydrogens bonded to the fatty acid chain, and that means that there's less work for our bodies to break down if you happen to eat one of those unsaturated fats. Saturated fats have all the hydrogens bonded to their fatty acid chain. Notice there are no double bonds there, all single bonds. And because they're all single bonds, there are no kinks in those fatty acid chains. No bends, no kinks. Now, the nature of the fatty acid chain that is saturated is that it lays flat. I think you'll notice that in the picture. And in fact, it stacks right on top of another fatty acid chain. So at room temperature, would you expect a saturated fat to be solid or liquid? It is solid. Okay, back to the grocery store. What kinds of examples would you pick that are saturated fats?
Butter.
Butter Crisco. Yeah. The stuff that tastes good, right? Okay, so butter, margarine, lard, Crisco, any of those solids at room temperature classify as saturated fats. And just looking at the chemical structure, why do you think they're a little more unhealthy for us?
There's more hydrogen.
More hydrogens, right. The more hydrogens you pack into that fatty acid chain, the more work we have to do to burn them off. So unfortunately, they can clog up our vessels and cause heart disease and cardiovascular issues. So yeah, unsaturated fats, they say, are more healthy for us. Okay, so let me tell you about the two types of unsaturated fats about midway of your page. So let's take a look at this picture. On the far left, you'll notice a straight fatty acid chain hooked to the orange glycerol head at the top. Would you classify stearic as saturated or unsaturated?
Saturated.
How do you know?
Straight, no
kinks. Okay, take a look at oleic acid. This particular one has only one bend in the fatty acid chain. Saturated or unsaturated?
Unsaturated,
right? It has one bend or kink. And what is that bend due to?
Lack of hydrogens,
right. And of course, there's a double bond there, so that's why we have a kink. That double bond's pretty strong, and it pulls tightly on the neighboring carbon atom. Now you take a look at linoleic acid, and there's kink after kink here. This comes from many double bonds present in the fatty acid chain. This one is also unsaturated. So let me tell you the difference here. Oleic has only one only one double bond. It is called a monounsaturated fat. Because linoleic has numerous double bonds, it's poly, you got it. Okay, so polyunsaturated fats have many double bonds. Okay, that's your blank there. Polyunsaturated fats have many double bonds. Sure. No, not yet.
So just look for the many bends or kinks in the chain.
The kinkier it is, the healthier it is. All right, so now you're in the grocery store and you're reading food labels and you now have the option of picking one of these three. Which of these three is the healthiest choice?
Linoleic,
right. How come?
It's
got less hydrogens. It's got a lot of double bonds. That means less energy for you to burn it off. So the kinkier the fat, the better it is for you health-wise. Your second choice?
Oleic,
yeah. It's still unsaturated. It's not great, but it's better than the saturated fat. Why is the saturated fat your worst choice? more hydrogens, right? That packs quite a punch of energy. That's a lot more work for us to burn off. So there's more of a risk there for cardiovascular disease with that saturated fat. Okay? So unsaturated fats, always better than saturated fats, and your absolute best choice is a polyunsaturated fat. Okay? Polyunsaturated fat, your absolute best choice. How about questions on that page?
So whenever you quiz us on tests on stuff pertaining to saturated fat, you basically show us something like that?
I may show you a picture or may have words, so you want to know both.
Are we going to have to know the steric, the leic, and one of them?
Don't worry about those. I would just be able to spot something like that and say, that one's probably your polyunsaturated.
Okay, so not worry about
it. Not worry about the words, yeah. So what we've just gotten through talking about is specifically the fatty acid chains. And, of course, we kind of ignore the head in the whole story because we're so focused on the fatty acid chains. And that kind of carries over to the next page, that theme and conversation about fatty acid chains is at the very top of page 21. And so often when you read food labels, you'll notice that there are different types of glycerides listed on there. Well, that doesn't refer to the quality or how many hydrogens you've got bonded. That only tells us how many fatty acid chains are bound to that one single head. Okay? So a monoglyceride is what you're looking at here. Here's the head, the polar head, and here is your fatty acid chain. By the way, even though it's a monoglyceride, what do you know about that fatty acid chain?
It's saturated.
It's saturated, yeah. So this is a monoglyceride because there's one fatty acid chain attached to the head, and it just so happens to be saturated. Some products have on their food labels that they are diglycerides. And you may look at that and say, well, that doesn't sound too bad. Di means two. But look, you have now doubled your fatty acid chains. You've doubled your energy capacity. And, of course, that means more work on your behalf to burn this one off. So in blue on the left, that is your head. And these are two saturated fatty acid chains. This gets really busy, doesn't it? This is a triglyceride. What does that tri mean?
Three.
So what are there three of?
Three fatty.
Three fatty acids, right. Now, if you had to pick the most healthy glyceride, which one would it be?
Monoglyceride.
Monoglyceride, yeah. Even though there are still saturated chains here, the monoglyceride simply has less of them. So if you happen to notice on food products, triglycerides listed there, that's really the most packed form of energy storage we've got. And these here are all saturated. That's a lot of energy stored there. In your body, the triglycerides circulate in your bloodstream. Triglycerides are an indicator for heart disease risk. So if a blood test reveals that you have high levels of triglycerides, you've got these molecules floating through your bloodstream. They're most likely going to take up residence either in your bloodstream, yikes, because they can clog it, or they can take up residence in your fatty tissues. So either way, it is an indicator for cardiovascular disease risk. Things like plaques that could be built up in your bloodstream. Okay, so keep in mind what we've just discussed are two different issues. We've talked about how many double bonds or single bonds are in fatty acid chains, and we describe that as saturated, monounsaturated, polyunsaturated. And now we've just gotten through talking about the numbers of chains. So you can have three saturated chains per head, and we would call that a triglyceride. So the numbers versus the quality of the construction, there's two things that we've been looking at so far.
Are the glycerides just considered saturated fat?
Most of them are, yeah. Do y'all have questions so far?
So if you were to test on the
give you pictures or words. I'd either say, tell me what I've got, or I'd say, I've got one head and two chains, tell me what I've got. Okay. Old, if you haven't seen the Old Test, they've got really good samples of what I do, whether I ask a picture or words.
So the one head, two chains, Douglas, right?
One head, two chains is Douglas, right? That's right. This is a, go ahead.
Any questions from the Old Test that you have posted on B2L?
They might be, but I wouldn't study them thinking that they're going to be. If they show up again, the same wording and everything, it's just kind of a gift. You know, I might change the wording. I might smooth it out a little bit. I might change the answer choices. So the answer, yes, they may show up again, but I wouldn't study thinking that you'll ever see that exact wording again. I think it sets a trap for you that your brain expects to see it worded just the same way. These are phospholipids, and you'll notice something familiar. Would you classify these as mono, di, or triglycerides? Good. How did you know?
Two chains.
Two chains, right? There's a head, of course, and there are two fatty acid chains. One of them is saturated. Which one? The straight one. Good. The one that's just no kinks in it at all. And the other chain has one single bend in it. That one is what?
Unsaturated.
Is it mono or polyunsaturated? Mono. It has one bend. It's monounsaturated. Okay, with me so far? Okay, haven't lost you anywhere, have I? Okay. Now, there's something special about this one. Yes, it is a diglyceride. Yes, it has a saturated straight chain and a monounsaturated chain. But that head is special because right there is a phosphate group, and that's why we call it a phospholipid. This particular kind of fat is special because it makes up the plasma membranes of our bodies. So think about the trillions of these that are found in your body, and they always orient where their heads are out, where they can encounter water, and the tails high because they don't like water. Keep in mind, the heads are hydro what? Phil, good. And the tails are?
Hydrophobic.
Good. Okay. So in this picture, you can actually see what looks like a sea of golf balls, and these are all the hydrophilic heads, and those chains actually sit on the inside of that membrane. There are, in fact, two layers here in your typical plasma membrane. I'm not going to talk about these. You can cross them off of your worksheet. Okay, eicosanoids, those two, leukotrienes and prostaglandins, feel free to cross those off your list. Yay, it makes you feel good to mark something out of your course pack.
So don't have to know those.
Don't have to know those. I'm not going to test you on those. Yeah, just leukotrienes and prostaglandins, you can mark that off. Now, the last one in this category is an oddball. It doesn't follow the rules. And so what is the rule? What is the monomer of a fat? Got a glycerol head and fatty acid chain. So you may have one or two or three, but you look at a picture of a steroid and you say, I don't see a head and I don't see any fatty acid chains, and you would be right. There are no heads nor tails in a typical steroid. In fact, some textbooks say they shouldn't be put in the fat category. They don't follow the rules, but they kind of go along enough so that people say they kind of follow the rules enough to be considered a fat. And so steroids are actually common in our bodies. They help form the basis for things like sex hormones and also for other hormones like aldosterone and cortisol. The most common one in our body, however, is a chemical called cholesterol. And so this could be cholesterol here. It's made up of four fused carbon rings. So let's find those four rings. This is a six-sided ring right there. Okay, here's our second ring, our third ring, our fourth ring, and we were working on a fifth one, but we didn't quite get it made. So you've got four complete fused rings and a portion of one that's kind of sitting there open. So this is a very common molecule in our body. It also is hydrophobic, just like other fat parts are. And so cholesterol, which is an important component of our cell membranes, is a great example of a steroid, as are several different kinds of sex hormones. So what are some examples of sex hormones? Good. Testosterone, estrogen, good. And then when you get to Bio 211, we'll talk more about steroids.
So out of that, what do you want us to take away?
Steroids are a type of lipid. I would know that cholesterol is an example of a steroid. And I think that should probably cover you. I would also be able to recognize that picture at the bottom of your page as being a steroid. The four fuse rings are probably the dead giveaway for that one. Okay, so let's talk about proteins. These proteins are on the next page, top of page 22. At the very top of your page, you'll notice that there is our monomer or building block, one of the must-know items about the proteins. Amino acids are the monomer or building block. No surprise that the top four elements compose these proteins. Those are carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. And there's also an amount of phosphorus and sulfur in our proteins, so they do help to make our chemical structure of our proteins. So proteins are really common in your body. In fact, you couldn't live without them. They do help form either the structure of your body, or they help to do some kind of function. So we actually divide them into structural proteins or functional proteins. Those functional proteins there are just listed as an FYI. Don't memorize the list. Okay? Those functional proteins are listed there as an FYI. Don't memorize the list. So some examples in our bodies are things that you may have heard of before. Hormones are often classified as proteins. We're going to talk in just a moment about enzymes. And then I think we all probably came to this class knowing that hair, muscle, and nails are great examples of protein. One interesting thing about proteins is that they are held together with a special set of covalent bonds. It is such a special bond that we call it a peptide bond. When I hear the word peptide, I want to think about proteins. So take a look at this peptide bond. What elements are found in it? Yeah, carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen. So our top four elements, right? Okay, so you'll want to know that peptide bonds are uniquely found holding together amino acids. They're only found in the protein group. So you're not going to find peptide bonds in between, say, carbs. You're not going to find them in between lipids. You're only going to find them holding together amino acids of a protein. Underneath the picture, it says during protein synthesis, amino acids are joined together to form dipeptides or polypeptides. What's the difference? Two and poly? Yeah. Many, many, right? This one here has two, so how would you classify this particular protein? It's a dipeptide, right? Really simple, actually pretty tiny dipeptide, not a polypeptide. How would you classify this one? It has more than two amino acids. Polypeptide, good. So I'd like to walk you through the types of protein structures near the bottom of your page. Notice they go in order from primary, secondary, tertiary, and quaternary. You know you're counting, right? Okay, so primary is the first or simplest structure, and a lot of people describe this as beads on a string, and I think that's what you see here. It looks like a string of pearls or a string of some form of beads. This is the simplest form of protein structure. Secondary structure is one of two forms. Either it takes on a beta-pleated sheet, which means you take a piece of paper and you make an accordion out of it. Okay, so taking your piece of paper and making an accordion is what we call a beta pleated sheet. Another form that proteins take at the secondary level is called an alpha helix. The best way to describe that is to think of a spiral staircase or curl. Okay, so that is a second level of protein structure that some proteins take on. That's secondary. Now, most proteins actually twist themselves up quite a bit because structure drives the function, and of course, function drives the structure in turn. This is our third level of structure. I think this looks like a bunch of unraveled ribbon. And to me, it doesn't make much sense, but to that protein, that's critically important. That particular structure is what allows it to do its particular job. What do you think would happen to that protein if I changed its shape? It'd become a different type. Yes, it wouldn't do its work, and I wouldn't be able to do what I needed to with that particular protein. Let me put it to you this way. If I take your car keys and your house keys, and I melt them down, and I make new forms, and I give them back to you, what the heck, right? You can't get in your car, you can't get in your house. So that's the same concept with proteins. If you change their shapes at the tertiary and quaternary levels, they're not able to do their jobs anymore. So what do you find in a quaternary level protein? One protein or many? Two or more, yeah. And they've color-coded them for you. There are, in fact, four different polypeptides all hooked up together in this particular one. You're going to talk about some common polypeptides when you go through this course in the next one. Hemoglobin actually contains four different polypeptides. This is quaternary level structure. And of course, collagen there on the left is another quaternary level polypeptide. So quaternary level simply means it is the most sophisticated level of structure for a protein. That is the highest number of twists that protein can do. Okay, so that should do it for page 22. How about questions there?
Would you show us these pictures, basically?
Any pictures, any words, yeah. So anything that's on the course pack or something similar to what we do up here, that's something I would feel comfortable being able to identify for a test. I'd like to take you just on a detour for a moment. This is an enzyme, and I'd like to talk to you about this special type of protein. It's over on page 23. Enzymes help to run a process that we call metabolism. You may know that metabolism is a set of chemical reactions in the body. It's both anabolic building reactions and catabolic breakdown reactions. So enzymes are critically important for maintaining our metabolism in the body. You'll notice that enzymes work together with specific substrates. So it's like having a key for your house and no one else's house. You know, enzymes are going to work only on specific types of chemicals. They just don't work on everything. So we say that enzymes are substrate specific. If you look at the bullet point there, you'll notice it says enzymes often have an ending of A-S-E. A-S-E says to you, I am an enzyme. Now, they often work on sugars or proteins or other kinds of molecules. If you happen to have a sugar that it's working on, the sugar will have a similar ending of O-S-E. Let me give you an example of how this works. We've got a sugar that we just talked about called cellulose. Cellulose is worked on by an enzyme called cellulase. Now, we're unfortunate we don't have the enzyme cellulase, so guess what? We can't break down cellulose. Let me give you another one. If we have, say, a sugar called sucrose, what's the enzyme that works on sucrose? Sucrase, right. Hey, we're lucky there. We do have sucrase as an enzyme. Helps to break down sugar. And if you break down sucrose, what are the two building blocks? Glucose and
fructose.
Good. All right. Now, enzymes come together with their very specific substrate at a special point called an active site. Notice it looks like a lock and a key fit. So this means, and it reminds us, that this enzyme can't just go work on any old substrate. It has to work on only specific substrates. Let me give an example of why enzymes are so important for your body. They help to lower something called the activation energy. Now, if I had the task of pushing a 400-pound ball up and over that very high hill, and I was all by myself, and this is my job alone, I would huff and I would puff, and I would get really hot and really tired doing that job. I might eventually get it up and over that hill. What enzymes do is they come along and they say, hey, I heard you've got a really impossible task of pushing a 400-pound ball up and over a hill. I'm going to help you out. I have a shovel. And so I'm going to take your hill down from way up there to way down here. And so the enzyme says, ta-da, I've lowered your energy level so that you have to no longer do as much work. So now when you try to push your 400-pound ball up and over the hill, you huff and puff a little bit, but it's a much easier task to push your ball up and over the hill and then get the chemical reaction running. So my point here is the enzymes help us out by making our energy or chemical reactions run with less energy. What this means for you is you don't have to work as hard, not that you feel it, right? You don't know this is happening. But inside, you don't heat up as much, you don't get as exhausted doing these chemical reactions, and so your enzymes actually make the reaction run more smoothly and with less energy. So we say that enzymes lower your activation energy. They shovel down the hill, they help you out a little bit. Does that make sense? Okay. Just wanted to mention a term to you called denaturation. Okay, about midway down your page, denaturation. Why is denaturation bad for an enzyme? Yeah, so what does that do to your active site? It won't fit, yeah. Goodbye to your protein or your enzyme if you denature it, right? So let me give you some examples of how you can denature proteins. If you cook meat or protein like egg, you permanently change the shape and it can never go back to its original form. So heat is one good example of what can denature a protein. Okay? You'll also notice there that acids can denature proteins. That means that we permanently change the shape and it too cannot go back to its original shape. If you've ever eaten or heard of pickled eggs, vinegar is an acid that actually permanently changes the shape of the egg. So that means we can't go back to a liquid state after we've changed it with an enzyme or with an acid like, say, vinegar. For those who have chemical straighteners or chemical perms to curl the hair, that also relies on denaturing the protein. We actually permanently change the shape of the protein using chemicals like acids. Okay. So in the picture down below, can you tell me what is your enzyme on the far left? Lactase. How did you know? ASE. Good. Lactase is your enzyme. Lactose is your substrate. By the way, this substrate happens to be what type of organic compound? Carbohydrate, good, good. So lactase is your enzyme, lactose is your substrate. It just happens to be a carb. OSE means I'm a sugar. What's that? Good.
I'm just trying to figure out how it was a carb.
Yeah, OSE is the clue. The middle picture shows the two coming together at an active site. That should be a lock and key fit. They should fit together pretty well. And then what you've got on the far right are the products. Let's think big picture here. Did you just build or break down lactose?
Break down,
yes. So you broke it in from one big unit into two smaller units. That is a great example of a catabolic reaction. Okay, so you took one big unit, broke it into two smaller units. That's a great example of a catabolic reaction.
And you said the OSE was a carbohydrate?
OSC says I'm a carb. Yep.
The active side is in the middle where they bond.
Where they bond, yeah. Hey, just for fun, here's another one. Do you see the active site there? It's a pretty nice snug fit, right? Okay, so there's your enzyme. That stuff is your substrate. And this particular enzyme broke the pieces apart too. So I want to make the point that enzymes can not only help join things together, but they can also break them apart. It just depends on what your body needs, but they can do one or the both of those kinds of reactions. All right, so how about questions there on page 23? Anything with proteins? Anything with enzymes? For structure of proteins, I would yet know that they fall into two categories. And the common ones that most of us have heard of, like hair, nails, muscles, enzymes, that's about the extent of the examples we'll look at. So one last category here, which is actually going to tide us over into our next topic, that's the nucleic acids on page 24. So to highlight at the top of your page are the monomers, which are nucleotides. You know, most of the time when we talk about nucleic acids, we talk about their function as DNA and RNA and their role as being genetic storage devices. But in fact, we know that there is also ATP, which actually isn't a genetic storage device. It's an energy molecule. So you may wonder why in the world we've stuck ATP in a category that contains DNA and RNA. So what are the reasonings here? Why do it? Say that again? Sure. Why do we put ATP in the category with DNA and RNA? Two totally different functions. Good, good. The structure is what they have in common, exactly. So we look at, say, ATP, and we say, hey, that looks very similar to what DNA and RNA are constructed from. Now, this is interesting about a nucleotide. A nucleotide actually contains three components. One is a phosphate group. We have some form of a sugar here. And we have at least one nitrogen-containing base. We call it a nitrogenous base. So we're going to focus on how the nucleotide forms the building block of all three of these examples. I'm going to show you a picture first of DNA. And we're going to look for a phosphate, a sugar, and a base. So you'll notice the P is our phosphate group. There's S for our sugar. And in the middle here is one of our bases. That one happens to have a C on it. Now that makes up one nucleotide of our DNA molecule. Here's a second nucleotide, phosphate, sugar, and this time the base has a G. Here's another nucleotide, a phosphate, a sugar, and a T. And then finally, we have another phosphate, sugar, and an A that time. So you may know that the nucleotides for DNA are actually named by their bases. What does C stand for?
Cytosine,
good. And G? Guanine, good. T? Thymine and A. Adenine, good. So the names of our nucleotides actually come from the four different bases we may see in a DNA molecule. You'll notice that they're in fact made up of two molecules here. You've got one set of nucleotides on one side. Here's another set of nucleotides over there. And these are dotted lines holding together those two strands. What kind of bond holds together those strands? Dotted lines.
Hydrogen.
Hydrogen, yeah. So there's three hydrogen bonds there, and two up there. So, you know, not a real strong set of bonds, but nonetheless, that's what holds together the DNA molecule. So I kind of think of your DNA molecule like a zipper. And, of course, those hydrogen bonds are the act of literally zipping the zipper. And because there's so much information stored here, you can't just say, I'm going to put this in the nucleus and just kind of shove it in there. It's actually very neatly twisted into a spiral set up like this. And then that's twisted in upon itself into a very nice, neat, condensed package. So this spiral look that you see on the right-hand side, it's all about space conservation. We've got to stick 23 chromosomes in your DNA, or of your DNA in your nucleus, and that's got to be very neatly packaged.
So the DNA is always going to be held with hydrogen bonds?
Always held with hydrogen bonds, that's right. You'll notice that RNA is actually similar in structure. We know that RNA, like DNA, is built from building blocks called nucleotides, and nucleotides have three components: a sugar, a what? Phosphate, and a nitrogen-containing base. Good. So let's find them. This time the sugar is ribose instead of deoxyribose. Okay. So the sugar in RNA, of course, is ribose. The sugar in DNA is deoxyribose. Once again, there's our phosphate group. And this time we have four bases. So it sounds a lot like it's the same thing. But do you see two strands or one strand this time?
One.
Just one strand. And something else that's different here. What about your bases? Uracil, not thymine. Okay, so take a look. You have adenine in both DNA and RNA. You've got guanine and cytosine in both DNA and RNA. But back here when we looked at DNA, we had the T's, which stands for thymine. But over here in RNA, we replace it with a similar structured compound called uracil. So uracil replaces thymine in our RNA molecules. So on your worksheet, I left you a little question there that says, what are three differences between DNA and RNA structure? Can you tell me one difference? Good. Number of strands differs. Good.
The thymine
uracil issue. Good. That's another difference. The sugar. Yeah. So ribose here and DNA have deoxyribose. Okay. So to summarize, number of strands, thymine versus uracil, and the sugars differ. So ribose here in RNA versus deoxyribose in DNA. Thymine versus uracil. Okay, so in summary, the three differences are number of strands, thymine versus uracil, and your sugar is different, ribose versus deoxyribose. Three differences are number of strands, okay, thymine versus uracil, and the sugars, ribose versus deoxyribose.
So for under ATP, I know you already told us this, but it's in this category because it has like the same building blocks.
Same building blocks, yeah. So here's a side-by-side comparison of DNA and RNA. I think this picture really drives home the double-stranded nature of DNA and the single-stranded nature of RNA. Finally, we have ATP, and this one, of course, is an energy molecule. ATP is adenosine triphosphate. And this time you have adenine as the base, ribose as the sugar, and you have three phosphate groups. So ATP is kind of like a credit card in a way. If you've got a credit card, you know, you can spend money and use it to do work in the body. But of course, if you happen to lose one of these phosphate groups, it's like having no money. So you can't spend your money if you don't have any there to spend. Well, at least that's the way it's supposed to work, right? Okay, so if you've got ATP, this is the high energy form. This means you have the energy to do work in your body. And we're going to talk about what kinds of work you can do. Everything from breathe to muscle contractions to moving things across cell membranes. So you wouldn't be able to live without having ATP as an energy molecule. So yeah, why is this one considered a nucleic acid? What does it have in common with DNA or RNA? Structure, yeah. There's your nucleotide that contains a sugar, a phosphate, and there's a base. A sugar, a phosphate, a base.
That's what we need to know about ATP, is we have to have it, and the reason it's there is because it's similar structure.
Similar structure, yeah, it's an energy molecule. In the time we've got left, what I'd like to do is introduce you to a similar concept found over in chapter 3. We've actually talked about some of this stuff already today. To give you a little sneak preview of some cell information, we're going to work through a little bit of this today, and I'd like to give you some background. This is called the cell scale. It's a product the University of Utah put together, and these are things that we should be able to see with the naked eye. Of course, you can see a coffee bean and a grain of rice with the naked eye. No magnification really needed for those kinds of things. If we use the scale here at the very bottom, we're going to work through to the microscopic structures that are commonly found in a cell. You know, I imagine that most of us can probably see sesame seeds and grains of salt as well with the naked eye. So we're still dealing with what is not going to require a microscope in order to see. Watch what happens as we start to scroll in. You now can see one of the first cells. You've got a human egg up there at the top in comparison to some pond cells, amoebas and paramecium. So at this point, you now need a microscope. And in the top left corner, they're telling you the scale of this. We're now dealing with stuff that is beyond what the human eye can see. As we keep working on in, you'll notice that we now can see a skin cell. That photoreceptor cell is found in parts of your eye. And then the teeny tiny sperm cell. But look at all this stuff right here that just looks like little tiny specks. That's where we're going. Okay, red blood cell, there's a chromosome over there, and look, there's even more stuff there. That's where we're heading. But that human egg cell looks like a big monster. It's so large compared to this stuff. So when you get sick and you have, say, a bacterial infection, those teeny tiny bacteria are even smaller than our chromosomes. That really drives home how powerful they can be in making us sick. There's, of course, a mitochondrion and a lysosome. What are they? They're organelles, yeah. So they're as small as a bacterial cell. And there's even smaller stuff there. There's viruses. There's measles, the flu, HIV. Dead center there looks like another little speck, and that, in fact, is a hepatitis virus. We're going to talk today or Monday about tRNA. Hemoglobin, that is a quaternary level protein, and in terms of the human body, that's a pretty big protein, but look how tiny it is compared to everything else. And then there's even smaller stuff. there's glucose, water, and finally in the dead center, there's a carbon atom. So there's adenine. We were dealing with that a little bit ago. So pretty cool thing to kind of give you a feel for how small the stuff is that we're dealing with. So what we're going to start off with is talking about structures common to pretty much any cell of your body. And on page, goodness, what is that, 28, we have our plasma membrane first. What do you recognize about this plasma membrane? Phospholipids, good. What else? Yeah, extracellular fluid out here. Any of these terms like cytoplasm, are they familiar? Okay, so let's take the first thing first. And on your worksheet, you've got a lipid component, which is two layers of phospholipids. Two layers of phospholipids. You might recall these phospholipids have glycerol heads that are hydrophilic. Yeah, loves water. And the tails hate water. They are called hydrophobic. Yeah. So these two tails, you'll notice when we go back to the big picture, are actually oriented toward the interior of your plasma membrane. And yeah, there are two layers of phospholipids. Heads are pointing out because they're bold and brave and they love water. And the tails are scared to death of it, so they hide on the inside of your plasma membrane. You know, I think of those phospholipid tails like dogs. You know, dogs that have been fussed at tuck their tails between their legs and they run off and they hide. And that's exactly what phospholipids do, is they tuck their tails into the inside of that membrane, and they're in there just scared to death. So this looks like a pretty firm, solid structure, doesn't it? Okay, let me give you a visual as to what actually is happening here. Imagine taking a bunch of balls and putting them out on the ocean and then watching them ride the waves. That's what these phospholipids are doing. This is not a firm brick wall that never moves and never changes. This is, in fact, a very flexible, a liquid membrane. So you can move things around. You can reposition these proteins. Things can come through. And it's not a wall built in stone. It, in fact, is a very liquid, very movable, semi-permeable membrane. So I hope that thinking of them as balls riding the ocean waves gives you a more realistic idea of what's actually happening with the phospholipid bilayer. We've also got a bunch of proteins here. We've got receptor proteins out here that detect, you know, things coming in contact with the cell. You've got recognition proteins, but I want to focus on the carrier proteins and the channel proteins. Those are the kinds of proteins that travel all the way through your membrane. Okay, so these proteins that travel all the way through your membrane are quite likely carrying things across the membrane. And because they travel all the way across the membrane, let's call them integral proteins. Okay.
Carrier and channel,
yeah, they are both integral proteins. Now, by contrast, you'll notice another term up there called peripheral proteins. Peripheral proteins are like these receptor and recognition proteins. They're only sticking on one side or the other. They don't travel through your membrane. So on the outer surface here, we have some of those receptor proteins, some of those recognition proteins. These sticking on the outer surface only are going to be peripheral proteins. Down here's a good couple of them. There's a nice peripheral protein there. There's another one. Now, there's also a carb component to your plasma membrane. These carbohydrates, you'll notice, are on the outer surface, not on the inner surface of your plasma membrane. Keep in mind, the whole function of your plasma membrane is to provide a boundary around your cell, kind of a protective device. And so these carb chains are out there to either identify the cell as who it is, or to identify it as part of you, or even to help the cell stick to a neighboring cell. So imagine if your cells didn't stick together, you would fall apart as one big pile of cells. So this glycocalyx on the outer surface is composed of a bunch of sticky carbs, and those carbs do help hold one cell to a neighboring cell. So I think of the outsides of our cells kind of like donuts, you know, sticky on the outside. They got goo on the middle, if you're thinking about one of those cream-filled donuts. All right, so down there near the bottom of your page, let's label those letters. Let's call letter A on that picture a carbohydrate chain. Let's call letter A carbohydrate chain. Let's call letter D an integral protein. Let's call letter D an integral protein. What about letter E?
Peripheral.
Good. So E is peripheral protein. Let's see, how about letter B? What would you call that? Polar head is good, sure. Polar head. And letter C? Nonpolar tails, that's good. Letter C is nonpolar tails. If you had to insert the area where you find glycocalyx, would you put it near the top of the picture or the bottom? Top, yeah. Glycocalyx is the sticky exterior of your cell. And so I would put it near where it says cell exterior. It is the outside surface. Glycocalyx is associated with your outside surface. Yeah, it's like all this, these carb chains and all these sticky outer features. They not only help you identify the cell as who it is, but then they stick to each other. So it's technically a sugar coating to the cell, kind of like an M&M or a donut. No wonder stuff likes to eat us like bacteria, right? How about questions so far? Everything making sense so far? I know it's a lot of just material, right? Let's see. To wrap up this page, at the very bottom you have cytoplasm. And cytoplasm is more than just water inside of a cell. It's got solutes and organelles, dissolved substances. And so cytoplasm we describe as a semi-fluid medium. I think having a mental image of Jell-O is a great way to visualize what cytoplasm actually looks like. Just not green as in this picture, right? So you'll notice there the term intracellular fluid refers specifically to the water inside your cytoplasm. That's just one of the components of your cytoplasm. Cytoplasm's more than water. It also includes solutes and organelles and dissolved substances. What's another term for intracellular fluid? Cytosol, good. So when we're talking specifically about the water in your cytoplasm, you can call it intracellular fluid, ICF for short, or you can call it cytosol. All right, so the function here is to hold organelles in place, provide a place for chemical reactions to occur. It kind of gives the cell some shape and some substance as well. So I got a couple of minutes left with you. I'd like to at least introduce the nucleus to you. It's on page 29. So most of your cells have a plasma membrane, cytoplasm, and a nucleus. And so the nucleus is kind of like the boss of the cell. This is where the directions come from for what the cell is supposed to do. So let's talk about the structure of the nucleus. It's often centrally located inside your cell. And I think it somewhat looks like a wiffle ball. So, you know, the whole goal here of the nucleus is to provide a boundary around your DNA to protect your DNA, but nonetheless, your DNA provides directions for how that cell is supposed to operate. If your goal is to protect the DNA inside a double-layered nuclear envelope, why in the world poke holes in it? Does that seem like a good way to protect stuff? It allows stuff to come and go. Yeah. So even though the goal of this membrane called a nuclear envelope is to protect the DNA on the inside, you gotta have a way for the messages to get out. And so, yeah, those holes are called nuclear pores, and they're there to help you get communication to and from the nucleus. You can't necessarily wrap it up and prevent communication from occurring. So what you're looking at out here is called the nuclear envelope. The holes are the nuclear pores. Inside your nucleus, you have more fluid. It's kind of like cytoplasm. But because it's inside the nucleus, what do we call it instead? Nucleoplasm, good. You know, when you've got a crowd, you've always got a party group, right? One that hangs out where the fun is happening. That's what the nucleolus is. So you've got a bunch of DNA hanging out inside your nucleus, but then there is this condensed region that shows up as a darkened spot when we stain cells. And that darkened spot is called the nucleolus. So that is a big collection of, say, proteins and DNA. That's gonna be just a kind of a hot spot, you might say, for some DNA inside your nucleus. Let's see, DNA structure there. We already know this stuff. What are the three components of a DNA molecule? Good, good. Sugar, phosphate, nitrogenous base. There's your three blanks. Okay, so number one is sugar. Number two is phosphate. And number three, there's possibility of four bases. They are A, T, C, and G, right? Adenine, thymine, cytosine, and guanine. So what I'd like to do is, on Monday, we'll cover DNA replication and protein synthesis. Have you ever had that stuff before? High school, maybe? Previous course? If you have not had that stuff in any course before, or if you don't remember it, do take a read in your textbook or course pack through 29 and 30. Don't forget about reading 31 and 32 as homework. And then most of our time in here is going to be spent on membrane transport on Monday. Do y'all have any questions for today? All right, y'all have a nice weekend.